Thank you. Yeah, I'm Chris Colnane from the University of Surrey and part of the Trustworthy Voting Systems Project. One of my co-authors, David Bismarck, is also in the audience. And I'm going to talk about our paper on authentication codes, primarily for PretaVote. So quick overview, I'm going to try and give a flying introduction to PretaVote. And then I'll discuss one of the key components of that, which is the digital signatures and how they're important. Before going on, just to kind of frame the discussion on human verifiable codes and then discuss our implementation of authentication codes and a short code variant and a further discussion on future work and some of our kind of ideas and discussion points. So for anyone who doesn't really know PretaVote, this is an example PretaVote ballot. The key components are that it's a perforated ballot down the middle from top to bottom, and the candidate ordering is in a random order across ballots. And this is very important because this is what allows you to cast your vote without anyone else knowing and take a receipt away. So you'll notice there's a barcode in the bottom right-hand corner, and that contains the encrypted onion, which allows this, after mixing, to be decrypted and for the vote to actually be tallied up. So let's imagine you're marking an X, you just put it in there, or if you're ranked election, it uses the same front end. And once you've completed your ballot in your polling booth, you then tear down the middle of your ballot paper and you destroy the left-hand side. So you actually shred it and get rid of it. And then you can take your right-hand side out into the public polling station and have it scanned. And once you've got it scanned, you get back a receipt which looks something like this. So it's basically a copy of this right-hand side, and you have some form of barcode, whether it be a QR barcode or a data matrix. And that contains a digital signature of what you've now submitted to the web bulletin board and should be recorded on the web bulletin board. So when you take this away, you can go home, you can then go to the website, type in your serial number, and up should pop this receipt. And so that allows you the individual verifiability to check that your vote has been recorded as cast and intended. And if everyone's been honest, then that works great. But what we have to consider is, what happens if one of the machines was dishonest? What happens if someone's trying to do something wrong? You get home, you look at your receipt, and you find that the thing on the web bulletin board doesn't match. So you rush back to the polling station and go, hey, you know, something's gone wrong here. They scan your barcode, and instead of finding a digital signature, they just find random data. So you now have no way of distinguishing whether the voter has created a false receipt or whether the machine cheated. And so you have no way of resolving this dispute. So you're now open to people both undermining a valid election or a machine cheating and not allowing you to be able to verify this. So what you need is a way for the voter to verify that their vote has been recorded on the web bulletin board in the polling station and to challenge it there as opposed to when you get home. I'll just note that the difficulty isn't because it's in a barcode. It's, you know, the actual byte value is below. The difficulty is people can't verify digital signatures in their head. So there's various ideas about this kind of related to other areas of work, so particularly kind of the human verifiable codes. We've seen it particularly in Pretty Good Democracy, PGD, with their acknowledgement codes. Scantegrity uses codes. It doesn't become directly applicable to PretaVote because of the nature of the randomised candidate ordering. There are proposals for PGD for ranked elections, but you typically end up with a matrix of codes, which is quite difficult to use, particularly as soon as you get to a large number of rankings. So what we ideally want is a simpler approach, which a user can, even if they don't understand the underlying kind of workings of the system, can actually verify that their vote's been recorded correctly. I will just mention that Peter will be presenting an alternative idea, which is more kind of extending the acknowledgement codes from PGD after this presentation. So the authentication codes, you want a universal front end for both ranked and plurality elections, and we want it to be simple to use. And it should provide assurance that the vote has been recorded as cast. So basically, how you put your vote in on the right-hand side has been recorded onto the web bulletin board. And this is the key point, that the verification and any challenge is performed in the polling station. If you just walk out the polling station, you can't challenge afterwards. So just to put a few kind of assumptions in place, these are pretty much standard assumptions which are in Pretivota anyway. We want a peered web bulletin board so that we can distribute the trust across many places. A trusted election manager, I'll probably just frame this slightly better because for anyone who's not familiar with Pretivota, that's not an individual, that's a diskless workstation under the assumption that it's observed during the construction of the ballot papers and in this case the authentication codes, and then it's destroyed at the end. So there's no information leakage from that point. And that's currently what happens with Pretivota. And there's a chain of custody on the ballot papers. So the ballot papers have to be kept secret anyway at the moment for your privacy, and we add an extra slip into that kind of ballot pack, which now allows you to verify that your vote was recorded as cast. So just to give you a quick overview of where it looks, just to frame it a bit, the standard kind of value here is what you'd have on your Pretivota ballot, and we've added this additional piece of paper on the right-hand side, which is the authentication strip. So you basically transcribe the values, I'll go through it in a bit more detail in a moment, from your vote onto this strip, and then on your receipt you have an additional strip of values, and as long as these two numbers match, so you're basically doing a two-number comparison row-wise, you can verify that your vote has been recorded by a threshold set to the peered web bulletin board. So I'll kind of go through it from the different perspectives of the election manager, the voter, and the web bulletin board. So in the election manager case, just a bit of notation, N is the number of candidates, and M is the preference range. So in the case of a ranked election, it's N, whereas in the case of, say, first past the post, it's 1. So basically, these are the possible rankings you could give to each candidate. And phi denotes a blank space in the code. So you take the values between 0 and M, along with 1 phi value, and you randomly permute that and then concatenate it n times. So I'll give an example of this in a moment. So in all these examples, we're using an n equals 4, so 4 candidates. So in this particular case, we take the values from 0 to 4, we add on a phi, and then we permute that and concatenate it on 4 separate occasions, and you end up with a value something like that. Obviously, the commas are only in there to make it easier to see the distinction between the blocks. And it's this value which is then printed out onto the authentication strip. Instead of where you have your phi value, you just leave blank the box. And the next step is to extract these locations of phi. And so in this case, it's 3, 7, 17, and 19. And you replace this phi with a 0. And this forms the initial authentication code which you have. And you now need to create an authentication value for each candidate. So basically, this is a 0 value, except it has a single 1 in the location where the phi was. So if we look at this example, we start with a generic 0 value, then we have a 1 in the 3rd location, a 1 in the 7th location, 1 in the 17, and a 1 in the 19th location. So you then take all of these values and you encrypt them using the shared public key. So we're using threshold cryptography on the peered web bulletin board. So you have the initial authentication value, and then you have 1 value for each of your candidates. And these encrypted values are then sent to each peer in the web bulletin board. So when the voter goes to vote, they go through their standard process as they have done before, except they now transcribe their vote from the right-hand side, which they have, onto this authentication strip. So in this particular scheme, you just go from top to bottom on the blank. So the shaded boxes would be blank. And so all you do is you transcribe the top value to the top blank, the second value to the next blank down, and so on. If it's a partially ranked election, or if it's first past the post, you insert a 0 where there's no ranking. So you then go through the standard process, you destroy the left-hand side, you pass in your right-hand side, but you must keep your authentication strip at least secret from the poll workers and the machine until you get your receipt back. And then when you get your receipt back, you just do this straightforward comparison. And if it matches, then you know that your vote has been recorded by the web bulletin board. If it doesn't match, you challenge there and then, and you go through a recovery procedure of having a new vote and discarding this one. So what's the web bulletin board doing in the background? Well, it receives a voting preference. So in this example, the vote was 3120. And so all it receives is this in that order, because obviously it doesn't have any of the left-hand side information. So each peer independently then constructs this authentication code from the encrypted values it has. It does a partial decryption, and then those partial decryptions from all the peers are publicly combined, and the plain text is then extracted and returned to the voter for the comparison. So the first step is to scale each of these authentication values you have for the candidates by the vote that you have. So obviously the web bulletin board isn't seeing the plain text, this is just for an example, it's just seeing the actual the encrypted values. So we're using a homomorphic scheme to then scale each of those values by the vote that has been passed in. So you can see the top one scaled by 3, the next one is scaled by 1, 2, and then 0. And the next step is to homomorphically add the authentication code to each of these authentication values, and this constructs you your completed authentication code, which you then must partially decrypt, and then you provide a proof of decryption, and you can then, each peer should have constructed exactly the same value because they're doing exactly the same operations on the same encrypted values. And all the valid partial decryptions, should anyone not have returned a valid partial decryption, it will be excluded. They are then all combined, and the plain text authentication code is then returned to the voter so that they can then do the comparison that needs to be done. So it's a fairly easy user interface in terms of they're just writing however many numbers they've already written into the right-hand side. It's fairly intuitive how the preference is blinded because you have it a one-half chance at best of guessing where the location of any one value is. However, the code length grows quadratically with n, which is clearly undesirable as you start to get any large number of rankings. It's getting pretty unmanageable when you've only got 4 candidates. If you get up to 9, it's quite clearly going to be completely unmanageable. So you can reduce this using a short code variant, and you can reduce the growth to linear growth, and you shorten the initial code as well, but there is an additional level of indirection which the voter has to go through. So to calculate the code length, you take n and a value p minus 1 times n plus 1, where n is still the same, the number of candidates, and p is 1 over p probability of guessing the location. So in the previous scheme, it was 1/2 chance of guessing the location of any particular authentication value. So in this case, that would make p equal to 2. So now with our candidate number at 4, we end up with an authentication code length of 9, which is far more manageable. So the voter perspective is very similar, except you have these labels which creates an indirection between the two values. So on the right-hand side of your ballot, you now have the labels A, B, C, D. They don't have to be letters. They can be any distinct labels, images, or whatever. And then on your authentication strip on the right, you have these randomized in a randomized order, and you have to map your value from your vote into that location. So you can see that the top one is labeled A, so you then have to enter that into A on the authentication strip, which is the second one down. B is the fourth one down, and then C goes to the second from last, and again D is blank, so that's a 0 value. So the election manager is similar, but slightly a few changes, so the notation remains the same. In this case, we take the values from 0 to M, with M still being the preference range, and then we take N number of blank spaces, and we randomly permute that. So again, the following example, we use N equal to 4. So if we have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we have 4 more blanks, we permute that and we come up with our shorter code here. And this will be the value which is then eventually printed out onto your authentication strip. But there is an additional step yet to go through. So the extra we extract the locations of 5, which is 1, 4, 7, and 9. And again, we replace the 5 with a 0 to create the same value here. And the next step is we now need to create these authentication values again. So we go through the same steps as we did before, putting a 1 in wherever we had a blank location. And we now end up in a similar situation. We have the authentication values and we have the authentication code, and we encrypt it using the shared public key. And now we have each value is associated. We now have to associate each value with a label. So we initially used a canonical order, A, B, C, D in this case, and we assign that to each one of these authentication values. And now we need to create that indirection which allows us to shorten this code. So we now randomly permute those labels, and this random permutation of that ordering is what's printed onto your authentication strip. So you can see that we haven't moved around the actual authentication values, we've only moved around the labels at this stage. So we then print this permuted list of letters onto the locations on the authentication strip where we have our blank values. And the next step is to then reorder those authentication values back into the canonical order of the letters or the labels or whatever kind of symbols you're using. And this is an important step to make sure that the web bulletin board does exactly the same processing as it did with the full length code. So the web bulletin board doesn't need to know whether you're using the short length code or the full length code, because the reordering of the letters allows you to then use exactly the same processing as you did before, do exactly the same construction on the authentication code, and doing the same partial decryptions. So in summary, we've got the same level of security as we did before. And it should be noted that whilst you have a 1/2 chance of guessing the location of any individual value, any individual blank location, you don't, if you try and change more of them and then change many votes, you end up getting to an infeasibly small number of changes. There is more work for the voter, but it's important to note that once the voter's destroyed their left-hand side and they have submitted their right-hand side to the voting scheme, they can be assisted in filling out the authentication strip. It won't break their privacy and it won't break the secrecy of their vote in that anyone else can see it because it becomes basically public information. And the interesting part of this is that what you can do once this has happened, because now you're verifying that your vote has been recorded by the threshold number of web bulletin board peers, you don't need to be doing the same check as you did before. So previously you had to go back home and you had to check onto the web bulletin board. But you no longer need to do this check. And it's since the unverified digital signature doesn't provide the properties we desire anyway, we think you can remove it because it doesn't provide you with what you need to do and it actually adds nothing to the process. If you leave it in and you're still allowing people to challenge, you still have the problem of undermining the election afterwards when a valid vote is undermined by a malicious person. It should also probably mention that there is an additional chain of custody burden on the authentication strip, but it doesn't seem that there's a way around this initially, although we have some ideas on how to do that. But there is already a chain of custody on the ballot anyway. So your privacy has to be protected by people securing these ballots and keeping them secure from the point they're printed to the point they're issued. So in terms of the kind of future work, an out-of-band construction of the authentication strip, so the idea that you could possibly construct your authentication strip at home and then bring it so that you don't have this chain of custody. There's some questions on how that impacts on coercion, whether it does or it doesn't, and that requires further investigation. You also have an interesting point on how do you audit that the authentication strip is correct, and it would seem that the most logical way is that you do something similar to what we would do at the moment in submitting a blank value and getting back a blank authentication code. But also an additional point when thinking about auditing, particularly PretaVote, is how do we now go about the audit process in PretaVote as well, which is as dependent on digital signatures as your receipts are. So if you audit a ballot in PretaVote, you'll get back a receipt with the left-hand side decoded, but you're now dealing with something which is signed. And if you want to challenge that, you need to go home, do whatever calculations to check it, and come back and challenge it. So you're as dependent on a digital signature. So the same problem occurs, and maybe we can use authentication strip to try and get around that particular problem. Okay, I'll happily take any questions now.
Stein, SRI International. One of your two use cases at the beginning was a voter who wants to discredit the election.
Yeah.
But what prevents me, if I'm such a voter, from walking in with a pre-made receipt that I go through the normal process, and then I, instead of going to verify the real receipt, I come up with a fake one. And so that's one question. The other question is, I had trouble following all these instructions that on the reorganization, everything like that. Have you done any usability tests? Do you have any reason to believe that any voter with a less than significant amount of training would be able to do this?
To answer the first question, yes, you can't really stop someone coming in with additional pieces of paper. But the advantage is that you're verifying you're doing the verification step there and then. So if they want to come in with a piece of paper, they can have their current vote removed and they can vote again. They can't discredit the election after leaving. So it doesn't really gain them an advantage in that sense. Because if you can't, unless you're going to search people coming in, people can come in with all kinds of stuff to an election situation. But you want to be dealing with those challenges there and then in the polling station as opposed to people going away, seeing who's won, and then potentially trying to discredit an election.
Okay, but if I, say, come in with a bunch of these or have a bunch of Confederate I'm sorry, if I come in with a bunch of these or have a bunch of Confederates who each individually come in with one of these fake votes, I can effectively completely discredit the election if half the people who come in do a challenge and or even a significant number of people come in and do a challenge, and if it keeps failing the challenge, then it pretty clearly intellectually discredits the election, even if it you can say, oh, you can cast another vote, that's okay.
You can do that now in the pre-vote scheme as it stands.
Oh,
in that,
but, I certainly agree. I'm just saying this isn't really solving the problem.
Well, it allows you to verify that it has been... It doesn't solve the problem of a malicious user trying to discredit an election, but there's many ways to discredit an election anyway. What it does stop is a malicious machine changing your vote. So, yeah, if someone wants to undermine the election from afar, then they're going to try and get as much press coverage to do that anyway. And it's going to be pretty difficult to stop that.
Vanessa Teague, University of Melbourne. I'm just trying to get to the bottom of exactly what the attack on my name is here, and exactly what attack this... I'm trying to get to the bottom of exactly what the attacker model is and exactly what attack this thwarts. I've talked to Peter and James a little bit about it as well, but I'll ask you. So if I understand rightly, we're talking about the time when the central authorities behave well,
yep,
but the polling station is corrupt. And the voter walks away with what looks like a plausible kind of a receipt, but which actually turns out to be bogus. And then the polling station doesn't post their vote, and they have no evidence after the fact that the polling station misbehaved. So I guess my question is, what's to stop the corrupt polling station from just printing their own ballots with their own nice-looking confirmation codes in such a way that the voter cannot test at the time? And then the confirmation codes all work out okay, but the receipt is still bogus.
That comes back to the chain of custody, in that then breaks the privacy of your vote anyway. If someone's able to print an authentication code which is going to be valid, they've seen the ballot paper anyway.
But they don't have to print an authentication code that's valid in the sense that it's on the bulletin board. They just have to print one that looks plausible to the voter at the time.
Yes, but if the ballot and the authentication code are sealed in the envelope, or what you would hope is a tamper-evident envelope. So if you're giving someone an invalid ballot, then you've got other issues anyway, because their privacy already has been effectively broken in that sense. So the chain of custody by then has been broken, and you should be catching that by auditing the ballot paper in pre-vote anyway.
Yeah, okay. I'm not saying that this attack is not possible in the existing pre-vote. I'm just saying that it sounds as if you're trying to solve at least part of a problem that... It sounds as if you're trying to improve upon the existing pre-vote,
yeah,
and its assumptions, right? So, and you're trying to say some level of corruption in the polling place can be detected at the time. But I don't quite see why a corrupt polling place couldn't print plausible-looking ballots under your scheme.
Because you're now assuming that they can also construct the tamper-evident envelope, and
yeah,
that, in which case you break in chain of custody. Because you're now allowing people to construct fake ballots.
But isn't the whole point of this scheme that it's supposed to be hard for a corrupt polling station?
It doesn't stop all attacks of corrupt poll stations which potentially exist. It's there because the digital signature doesn't help at all, in the sense that you go away and you found that you've got... If it's just a machine which has been corrupted, which is a lot easier to do because we don't trust the hardware which is used, then it can be affecting every single vote and you can't challenge it.
Okay, maybe we need to talk about this more
yeah.
slowly offline.
Hey, Chris. I want to praise this paper and encourage people to actually go and read it a little more carefully if they have any sort of concerns or questions about it. Obviously, there's a usability dimension, and I think that's important for people to note. But I really want to underscore that this is taking a big step forward for what is a major problem, like a real elephant in the room for these optical scan voting machine based cryptographic schemes. Certainly with us working with Scantegrity, we've had to deal with these, confront these problems, and we have a way to do it. But this scheme, I think, brings more properties to the table. And I think the great thing about this paper is it really brings to light this sort of circular logic that exists in the whole, you know, digital signature on the ballot thing. You know, you have to verify a signature, but you can't do that until after the fact, and so then you know, creates a whole ecosystem for disputes to arise, and this sort of addresses that. Okay. But then the question that I have is, all right, you we have a in these N10 schemes that use optical scan, like Scantegrity and Predivote and whatnot, you have a custody assumption for the purposes of preserving privacy, right? So you want to keep the association between serial numbers and codes secret. And because we're living in a physical world in these cases, it's not like the internet schemes where there's no physical dimension. There is a physical custody assumption. But traditionally, that custody assumption is just for privacy purposes. Now, in this scheme, it's also being used sort of to also protect integrity. And the thing is that if you could break custody, then the scanner could do like a man-in-the-middle attack between the web bulletin board and then, you know, Vanessa's thing with the, you know, ill-constructed confirmation codes kind of comes in. Is that not also kind of like this sort of same, is there not a circular logic there as well, kind of that, you know, sort of mirrors this digital signature idea that we're trying to solve?
There is an issue with the fact that your chain of custody now definitely, in, if you're including the authentication strip with the ballot paper, you now also have this integrity angle on it. Two points. I would prefer a scheme where you can construct your own authentication strip so that there is one in the ballot paper, but you can use one of your own if you want to. And that's kind of stuff we're looking at the moment. But the argument that the chain of custody only protects privacy, if you're able to, if you break that chain of custody, then you're now into the realm of being able to construct fake ballot papers, which potentially will impact on integrity. So if I can construct a ballot paper with a different candidate ordering which looks genuine, then you're voting for someone different.
But normally in a, you know, Predivote or Scantegrity or whatever scheme, you would address that with like a print audit, right? So you would have the, you know, the Benelo challenge or whatever kind of style, you know, where you take some and you audit it and, and you vote on the other one. So,
but in doing the audit, you need to verify a digital signature. Because otherwise, if the scan has been corrupted, you could construct something which makes the audit look correct. And it wouldn't be until you got home.
Okay, I guess in Predivote there's that particular.
So thing. Yeah, so okay. But yeah, that
okay.
That is.
All right, thank you.
Let's thank the speaker again.